Thank you so much for that very warm introduction. I'm going to talk today about a feature of our federal system that has been largely overlooked. First, I'm going to describe this feature just as a matter of theory, because I'm interested in thinking about the different ways in which state and federal law interact. But then I'm going to suggest that recognizing this particular kind of interaction is the first step toward answering a lot of everyday questions that currently confuse courts. So first, the theory. We know that pretty much all domestic American law has the authority of either the federal government or an individual state behind it. And we tend to think that the content of the law follows the same pattern. It reflects policy set either by the federal government or by an individual state. But that isn't really true. Sure, all legal rules that have the status of federal law are backed up by the sovereign authority of the federal government, and all legal rules that have the status of state law are backed up by the sovereign authority of an individual state. But the content of those rules isn't always tied to any single jurisdiction. Think, for instance, about how state common law works. Many legal rules that have the status of the law of one particular state are linked to and reflect the rules that other states recognize as law. I want to persuade you that something similar can be said about certain aspects of federal law. In particular, various legal rules that have the status of federal law actually get their content from state law, not in the sense that they reflect what any individual state does, but in the sense that they reflect what most states do. To show what I mean, let me tell you about a recent Fourth Circuit case called Wells v. Liddy. Ida Wells, the plaintiff, had been a secretary at the Democratic National Committee at the time of the Watergate break-in. 2 decades later, none other than G. Gordon Liddy gave some speeches suggesting that during her time at the DNC, Wells had been using an office phone to arrange business for a prostitution ring, and that this alleged link between the DNC and prostitution helped account for the break-in. As I understand Liddy's theory, White House lawyer John Dean allegedly authorized the break-in, and he allegedly did so in part to learn whether Wells' desk at the DNC contained pictures linking the future Mrs. Dean to the prostitution ring. Factual support for this theory was not necessarily plentiful. Wells sued Liddy for defamation. Some defamation suits don't raise any tricky choice of law questions, but Liddy, naturally, had given one of his allegedly defamatory speeches aboard a cruise ship while it was on the high seas. The Fourth Circuit was perfectly happy to apply American concepts of defamation law to Wells's claims about that speech. Given where the speech had occurred, though, it didn't make sense for the court to draw those concepts from the law of any particular state. The Fourth Circuit instead relied upon the Restatement Second of Torts, which the court took to reflect an amalgam of American defamation law. In the Fourth Circuit's words, the applicable rules of decision reflected, quote, general common law tort principles rather than the specific law of a single state. Many other federal courts of appeals have done the same sort of thing. To identify the rules of decision applicable to a whole host of maritime torts that have enough of a nexus to the United States to make the application of American tort law appropriate, but that aren't thought to be controlled by the law of any single state, courts often try to articulate a general American jurisprudence of torts. The tort law that courts apply in these sorts of cases is a sort of nationalized version of state law, the sort of tort law that one learns at a national law school. Courts take the same approach in other enclaves of so-called federal common law, areas that the Constitution has been understood to put beyond the lawmaking power of any individual state, but for which Congress hasn't supplied comprehensive rules of decision. Think, for instance, of contracts to which the federal government is a party, which account for a significant slice of the American economy. The principles of interpretation and other legal rules that determine the federal government's rights and obligations under these contracts don't vary from state to state. They're thought to be matters of federal law, not state law. To a large extent, though, courts derive them from what Judge Posner calls, quote, the core principles of the common law of contract that are in force in most states. Similar principles of general American jurisprudence often form the backdrop for federal statutes. That's true in several different senses. To begin with, when Congress uses undefined terms that are familiar to state law, courts often understand those terms to be referring to generalized understandings amalgamated from the law of the various states. For instance, the Supreme Court has said that when Congress used the word employee in the federal anti-discrimination statutes or in the Federal Copyright Act's definition of works made for hire, Congress was referring to, quote, the general common law of agency rather than the law of any particular state. To figure out the factors that affect whether somebody counts as an employee rather than an independent contractor for purposes of those federal statutes, courts therefore consult multi-jurisdictional sources like the restatement second of agency. Similarly, the Supreme Court has interpreted the word fraud in the federal bankruptcy code to be referring not to any one jurisdiction's concept of fraud, but instead to, quote, the dominant consensus of common law jurisdictions. Even apart from the definition of specific terms, the application of federal statutes often requires answers to questions that Congress has not explicitly addressed and that state law governs in other contexts. Courts facing those sorts of questions frequently assume that Congress was acting against the backdrop of general American jurisprudence, and they identify the applicable federal rules of decision by consulting what most states do. For instance, the Supreme Court has said that when Congress creates a federal cause of action that's analogous to a tort claim, Congress is acting against the backdrop of what the court calls ordinary tort-related vicarious liability rules, which the court associates with the general common law of agency. So the court has consulted the restatement second of agency to determine the circumstances under which Title VII makes an employer responsible for the hostile work environment created by one of its employees and the circumstances under which the employer is vicariously liable for punitive damages. Similarly, the court has drawn heavily upon the general jurisprudence of trusts, including multi-jurisdictional principles gleaned from the restatement second of trusts, to fill what the court sees as gaps in ERISA. And ever since the Supreme Court interpreted the Labor Management Relations Act to federalize the interpretation of collective bargaining agreements, judges have routinely invoked what they call general contract principles to answer questions that the Act doesn't itself address. You may wonder how that way of talking is even possible after Erie Railroad against Tompkins. Didn't Erie specifically reject the idea of general law, the brooding omnipresence that Justice Holmes derided as a source of rules of decision? The short answer is no, it didn't. Erie is just about the relationship between state and federal courts. When a state's highest court determines the content of the common law in force in that state on some question that lies within the state's legislative competence, Erie tells federal judges to accept its resolution, even if they would have taken a different view of the common law. But Erie does not say that the precedents and practices followed in various jurisdictions never fall into patterns, or that state judges shouldn't pay any attention to those patterns when they're trying to figure out the common law that's in force in their state. Similarly, Erie doesn't deny the potential relevance of those same patterns when judges are trying to answer questions that are not within the legislative competence of any single state, like questions in the enclaves of federal common law or questions in the interstices of federal statutes. The modern Supreme Court's view that Congress continues to legislate against the backdrop of the general law is therefore perfectly consistent with Erie. To be sure, if a state legislature enacted a statute that appears to incorporate background concepts of, say, agency law, it would be natural for courts to read the statute against the backdrop of agency law as it is understood and applied in that particular state. But when Congress enacts a similar statute, it will often be natural for courts to refer instead to a more general version of agency law. More broadly, there are plenty of situations in which it makes sense for courts and agencies implementing federal statutes to refer to some sort of national law on topics that typically are handled at the state level. In those situations, it's natural for them to refer to a species of general American jurisprudence that is informed by how each state does things, but is not controlled by the law of any single state. That's the theory part of the talk. The bottom line is that the idea of general law continues to matter after Erie, in part because it makes sense to read various federal statutes as drawing certain ideas from general law rather than from the local law of any individual state. Here's the practical payoff. Once we recognize this sort of interaction between state and federal law, we see that disputes about it lie at the heart of a lot of circuit splits. There are many issues on which different circuits have expressed different opinions that boil down to questions about the extent to which federal law incorporates principles of general jurisprudence. And that's something that principles of general jurisprudence can themselves help us to figure out once we know to look at them. Before I explain that last point, let me just give a few examples of the circuit splits that I have in mind. I'm deliberately going to focus on prosaic questions, questions of the sort that arise every day, but that remain surprisingly unsettled. Suppose that Congress creates a private cause of action to enforce some federal statute. Although Congress rarely says anything one way or the other about whether the causes of action that it creates can be settled out of court, courts routinely read federal statutes against the backdrop of principles of general jurisprudence that recognize release as a defense. So everyone agrees that when Congress creates a federal cause of action, the cause of action can be settled. But there are ongoing disputes about how much else federal law should be understood to say about the settlement of federal claims. Some circuit courts say that questions about the formation and interpretation of settlement contracts purporting to release federal causes of action are questions of federal law, and they derive the applicable rules by consulting statements of general jurisprudence, like the Restatement Second of Contracts. Other courts instead allow the local law of individual states to govern those questions. There are similar splits about the authority of attorneys to release their clients' claims and the effect of settlement agreements negotiated by attorneys who have apparent but not actual authority. When the underlying claims that are being settled come from federal law, some circuits answer those questions according to principles of general jurisprudence, like those found in the Restatement Second of Agency. Others instead use the local law of individual states. We could go on. Just as there are disputes about the release of federal causes of action, so too there are similar disputes about the assignment of federal causes of action. Likewise, there are enormous disputes about the relationship between federal statutes and background rules of corporate law. What happens if someone buys the assets of a corporation that faces liability under a federal cause of action? If the federal statute that creates the cause of action neglects that topic, to what extent does the local law of an individual state determine whether the federal liability passes through to the buyer? And to what extent should Congress instead be understood to have implicitly adopted principles of general jurisprudence to handle successor liability? These are hotly disputed issues in federal environmental litigation, say, and different circuits give different answers. All the circuit splits that I've just described are about the extent to which federal statutes incorporate general jurisprudence. But they're generated by disagreements about the statute's domains, the issues that the statutes should be understood to federalize. If a particular issue comes within the domain of federal law, but written federal law doesn't suggest any statute-specific rules to handle it, it's natural for courts to fill the resulting gap by drawing upon principles of general jurisprudence. So the controversial question in the splits that I've just described is about whether particular issues really do come within the domain of federal law. The key question in all of those circuit splits takes the following form. When Congress explicitly establishes federal duties backed up by federal causes of action, to what extent should courts understand Congress to be federalizing other issues that arise in conjunction with those causes of action? That's a question that general jurisprudence itself can help us to answer. widely accepted choice of law principles allow us to identify what some scholars have called policy bundles, clusters of issues that American policymakers are presumed to treat as a package, and that American choice of law analysis therefore lumps together. In the context of causes of action created by state law, for instance, the same state's law that governs whether a cause of action exists will also govern the measure of damages, the existence of substantive defenses, whether the cause of action can be assigned, and whether it survives the death of the original obligor or obligee. Those issues are all understood to be part of a single policy bundle. By the same token, when Congress creates a federal cause of action to enforce a federal duty, the circuits all agree that federal law governs those issues. To the extent that Congress hasn't established statute-specific ways of handling them, courts routinely draw the applicable federal rules of decision from general American jurisprudence, and they do so without much disagreement. Although courts don't necessarily speak in these terms, the basic idea that federal statutes creating federal causes of action implicitly federalize questions that occupy the same policy bundle as the cause of action, and that courts should use general American jurisprudence to fill gaps in the written federal law on those questions, is commonplace and uncontroversial. The circuit splits about the incorporation of general jurisprudence into federal statutes all involve issues that do not involve the same policy bundle as the cause of action. In my view, the splits exist because some courts have failed to appreciate the significance of that point, and they have therefore read federal statutes to go farther in incorporating general jurisprudence than the statutes really do. If you're going to read federal statutes to incorporate principles of general jurisprudence, that's fine, but those principles themselves suggest some outer limits on how far the incorporation goes. It's almost self-contradictory, I think, to assume that federal statutes incorporate principles of general jurisprudence to handle issues that principles of general jurisprudence themselves treat as lying in a different policy bundle than anything that the statutes address. To make that analysis more concrete, go back to the interpretation of settlement agreements. No matter what the cause of action that is being settled, American courts typically treat questions about the interpretation of settlement agreements like other questions of contract law for choice of law purposes. As a result, it would be perfectly natural for courts to say that Virginia law governs the elements of a cause of action, while New York law governs questions about the interpretation of a purported contract to settle the cause of action. The consensus on that point implies a consensus that American policymakers don't see questions about the interpretation of settlement agreements as being part of the same package or policy bundle as questions about the underlying cause of action. I don't see much reason to assume that Congress has a broader sense of the relevant policy bundles than other American legislatures. In the ordinary case, then, I wouldn't understand the typical federal statute creating a federal cause of action to federalize questions about the formation and interpretation of settlement agreements. Rather than reading the statute to incorporate principles of general American jurisprudence to handle that question, I'd say that the statute leaves those questions to be handled by the local contract law of individual states. Perhaps it's anticlimactic to end on that note. I started by pointing out this interesting thing that courts are doing, drawing rules of decision that have the status of federal law from patterns in what most states do. And I'm concluding by saying that some courts are doing too much of that interesting thing. But recognizing the continuing relevance of the general law is the first step toward figuring out when courts should and should not use the general law. It seems perfectly appropriate for courts to draw upon general law to answer questions that really do come within the federal domain, but for which written federal law doesn't suggest any statute-specific answers. There are many questions of federal law that aren't naturally controlled by the law of any single state, but as to which state jurisprudence in general is quite relevant. But if Congress does indeed operate against the backdrop of the general law, which the courts that take the incorporation of the general law too far have to believe, then judges should respect the limitations that general law itself suggests. I'll stop on that fiery note. Thank you for your attention on this beautiful afternoon, and thank you for everything that you do for the law school.